Okay. Well, this is the modest task that I have for the morning.
This is, by the way, this is the kind of assignment we gave all of our experts. You know, do a brain dump of everything that you know for journalists in 10 minutes.
So this will be a series of inverted pyramids of which you only get the lead of each paragraph. And I'll try and touch on as many of these as I can in the time we have. What I have in the lower left there is the figure that stands in front of our hospital, who's our World War I doughboy. And I put him there because he's so young. And it's just a reminder to me of who it is that we send to fight our wars. And if I can make this go to the there. So this is my brief definition of trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. The rest of it is commentary. A bad thing happens and it still bothers you. I want to give you a slightly more personalized version of that to consider. A gentleman that I met, some years ago now, who came to us after he had returned from Iraq, was in his early 20s at that time. He had entered the reserves. He was looking to get some support for school. He liked to go in the woods on weekends and blow things up, is the way his recruiting sergeant had offered him the opportunity, and that sounded really cool to the 18-year-old who signed up, except that he found himself at a checkpoint in Iraq in the early days of the war as a mid-level non-commissioned officer. As a specialist, he was sort of a squad leader, and he was in charge of this checkpoint at a point where a van started coming toward the checkpoint, and the rules of engagement were quite specific about who was going to be able to allow to come there and how close they were able to get, and the van did not respond to the signals that were being given to them. And he opened fire, and his squad opened fire, and stopped the van, as they were asked to do, and learned when they examined it that it was full of family that were no longer alive. And that was what he came to us with when he returned. And as we go through the rest of this very brief discussion, I just want to just hold him up as an example of the combination of kinds of things that we see happening. So specifically, the bad thing is called the stressor. It involves basically peril to life or limb, either of yourself or in your presence. And the way that it still bothers you have to do with re-experiencing, avoidance, and arousal, or the three clusters of symptoms. And there's a handout outside that will give you the current definitions of that, although I can tell you that those are under revision right now, and in a couple of years they'll look different slightly. But the re-experiencing symptoms mean you think about it. It comes back to you when you don't want to think about it. It comes back to you in your dreams. You react to it. You may have physiological symptoms when you think about it. You might get uncomfortable. And you try not to think about it. That's the avoidance part. You try not to feel the things that have to do with that experience. The arousal part is one of the deeply interesting biological pieces of it, because essentially what's happening here, and I'll get onto that in a minute, but what happens is your whole body is reacting to an emergency that happened whenever the event happened to you, except it keeps reacting as if it were happening again, or as if it were about to happen again, and you need to be ready for it. And for the diagnosis to be made, you have to have it for at least a month. And it has to be a disorder. It has to interfere with your functioning. It has to affect your life. It's not enough that you just had something bad happen, but it has to really diminish your capacity to function in the world. So this is your brain on trauma. This is, and there's some of the places that are noted, and I have this cool stuff on here. So the amygdala, if I can make it light up, there it is the place where your brain filters the stimuli to look and check whether anything in your environment is similar to anything that was a danger to you at some point. And if it thinks that it is, and it's not a very sophisticated filter, if it detects a resemblance, it sets off alarms. And one of the other ways of looking at what happens in PTSD is like you have a faulty car alarm that keeps going off even when it isn't supposed to. So what happens after that? Well, for a lot of people, they feel really upset at the time, and as time progresses, they get better. One study that was done quite some time ago now found that after a civilian trauma, like a rape, as many as 94% of the people who experienced it will meet the criteria for the disorder at the time of the event. But as time progresses, that can fall to as little as perhaps a third of them. That's still a lot. And those are the ones that we see. This is also one of the factors that's involved in making the decision about when you send the experts in to work on the trauma with people. Do you do it right away as soon as something happens? Well, not everybody's going to need it. So how do you sort that out? To be discussed further. Okay, the combat situation. So this is the place where people make split-second decisions that affect their lives and other people's lives. And all the reactions that are necessary and helpful in this setting are things that can be quite maladaptive in civilian life. In a combat situation, you've got to have all your senses very, very alert. You've got to be able to respond on an immediate hair trigger if you're going to survive. Mistakes are about life and death. Attention to detail is about life and death. Trusting the people around you is about life and death. All these things make a lot of sense in the combat situation, but you can begin to see how they create issues for you when you bring them home to your family and you're going on vacation and you said for everybody to be ready to be in the driveway in the station wagon at 0600 and it's 0630 and they're still not ready and you're going to miss the ambush, you know, but really nobody's going to die from that, but you're going to get just as upset. Anger and rage are things that happen naturally out of the fact that people are trying to kill you, but also they're part of the training to help you get out of the fear situations that you might otherwise become immobilized in. Sleep disturbance is a feature of the combat situation. It has to do with the hypervigilance. It has to do with the schedule demands that are placed on people. And later on, it can also have to do with the re-experiencing symptoms. Dissociation or detachment from emotions are, again, a part of it that makes relationships difficult, and Steve will talk about some of those things. Grief is not an emotion that you can express in the moment of the combat, and sometimes people bring that home. In addition, vulnerabilities to a host of other problems, cardiovascular problems, hypertension, and so forth, also are seen to flow from this. How do you get it? Well, guess what? The more bad things that happen, the more chances you have that it'll bother you. So if you were in more than 10 firefights, you have a lot more of a likelihood of getting PTSD. The longer that you've been deployed and the more times you've been deployed, the more chances you have of getting PTSD and other conditions. I mean, one of the things about PTSD is that it's not the only potential outcome, that there are lots of ways that these things express themselves. Not all of them meet those criteria, but they still can interfere with people's lives. So a brief look at the numbers. About 2 million people have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's a lot. considering we only have 100,000 or so in each place at a time. About a million of those, these numbers are about a year old. About a million are separated from the service and therefore veterans. About half of those have gone to the VA. Let's see. Of the ones who have been discharged, it's about half and half, whether they were active duty or reserve. So again, about half of them are in the situation of that young reservist that I talked about. So there's about a half a million people who have come to the VA between fiscal 2002 and 2009. They don't all have PTSD. They come up with other mental health diagnoses, and many of them come up with non-mental health diagnoses, a lot of musculoskeletal stuff from carrying 80 pounds of body armor and backpacks and so forth and jumping off of trucks and getting, not to mention getting blown up. What do you bring home from the war? You bring home a culture. You bring home a language. You bring home habits. You bring home a worldview about how you look at the world around you. So that's why this well-dressed couple is having this conversation about securing the perimeter, which otherwise they might not have considered. Again, the other issues that come up in time are let's look at the gentleman I introduced you to at the beginning. He was very depressed when I met him. My 12 minutes has completed already.
That's it. You're out of here.
Okay. I'll give myself the hook. So anyway, he was depressed. He was drinking. He lost his job. He lost his marriage. And in lieu of incarceration, he was actually under house arrest, and the only thing he was able to be released for was to come in for treatment, which he finally did. I can report that his symptoms are greatly relieved, but his life is still needs some work. I think that will be what I have time for. This only to say that moral injury is yet another thing that can happen that's not included in the PTSD definition, but clearly this gentleman is dealing with consequences beyond just the fear. He's dealing with guilt, he's dealing with shame, and those are things that need to be addressed even in addition to whatever other protocols he has to go to treat the rest of it. I'll stop there.